Welcome to the CROCcast, a podcast for peace studies conversations convened by the University of Notre Dame's CROC Institute for International Peace Studies, part of the Keough School of Global Affairs. I'm Atalia Omer, I'm professor of religion, conflict, and peace studies at the CROC Institute, and this year's faculty editor of peace policy. I'm joined today by Professor George Lopez, guest editor for our latest issue. George is the Rev. Theodore M. Hesburgh, CSC, Professor Emeritus of Peace Studies at the CROC Institute for International Peace Studies, someone I respect greatly, both as a colleague and as a friend. George, welcome.
Thanks so much, Atalia. I'm really delighted to be speaking with you and also our audience about the views of our expert colleagues that are shared in this issue of the peace policy.
Yeah, so this issue of peace policy focuses on the co-mingling of two existential crises of our time. Thanks to the expertise of our contributors, these are the threat of nuclear war and potential planetary destruction through climate change. Speaking of contributors, we have four scholars and also practitioners, each of whom has a wealth of knowledge and experience to share with our readers of this issue.
Yeah, I have known these good people and worked with them as individuals and sometimes collectively as professionals for a long while. And every time we partner on our work, be it in conferences, in shared research, or a writing project like this, I find that I continue to learn from them. And this issue of peace policy is no exception. They're really addressing, as you said, this dual threat to human survival and from interesting vantage points and expertise that they have, which contributes different angles of vision. Let me tell you a little bit about each of them. Rachel Bronson is the president and CEO of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, which of course is the lead magazine of the last 75 years on nuclear issues. She describes how the board of the Bulletin assessed in 2007 that the scientific research about the Earth's warming demonstrated a threat to human survival sufficiently equal to the threat of nuclear weapons. Accordingly, they decided these dual factors should influence the setting of the iconic doomsday clock, which is in the care of the Bulletin. Drew Mark Antonio and Christina Hook partner in an article that documents the entangled relationships between environmental disaster and nuclear security, and the terrible risks involved in this highly destructive and ongoing Ukrainian war. Drew is in the Department of Management and Organization within the Mendoza College of Business at the University of Notre Dame, as well as a fellow at the CROC Institute. Christina, meanwhile, is an assistant professor of conflict management with Kennesaw State University in Georgia. Both are doctoral graduates of our CROC Institute program, and they've collaborated before on other articles, especially one about this theme in the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. And finally, we have Jerry Powers, our own director of Catholic Peacebuilding Studies at the CROC Institute and the coordinator of the Global Catholic Peacebuilding Network. He synthesizes the manner and the substance by which Pope Francis has connected the urgent need to deal with the climate crisis and to achieve nuclear disarmament simultaneously. In addition to Jerry's work on this particular issue and his own writing on ethics of nuclear war, he has been this week at the UN in the second meeting of those parties that signed on to the Treaty for the Prevention of Nuclear Weapons. He's assisting the Vatican Nuncio there in his work. So, Atalia, as you noted, this edition of peace policy addresses this intersection of the threat of nuclear war and the devastating effect of climate change on our planet. The essays complement each other, providing a perspective on this dual existential threat in our era. The authors also coalesce around the need for contemporary citizen movements action, global leaders to respond so that we can meet the challenges of this era.
Thank you. So, George, let's talk about the first piece from Drew and Christina, our great graduates from our program at the CROC Institute. The title of the piece is Ukraine, an Intersection of Environmental and Nuclear Security Issues. Do they have a personal connection to Ukraine? And can you tell me more about the existing environmental hazards that have been exacerbated by the war with Russia? by the invasion of Russia to Ukraine, as well as the war's impact on global food security.
Yeah, the connection for Christina is considerable. For example, she had been there before even she came to the Kroc Institute for her doctoral work. She won a Fulbright Fellowship to do her dissertation work there on the terrible famine in 31 to 34 related to the Soviet rule there. And Drew has made a reputation very quickly internationally for his general work in environmental peace building, but also detailed studies of industrial pollution, what's that meant for the United States and a number of other countries. So their collaboration here is really significant, and they've done some deep dives into other aspects of Ukrainian environmental damage. In this article, they really take a detailed analysis of what's been happening in Ukraine, not only from this war, but also some detail on the destruction of industrial sites in the ongoing conflict with Russia in other sections of the country since 2014. Of course, they point out to us that the meeting point of nuclearism, if you will, at its worst, and environmental damage is well known in Ukraine, because in northern Ukraine is the Chernobyl site of the 1986 disaster. And they've experienced residue radiation for years in that. And it heightens the concern of the treatment of Russian occupation of the Zaporizhia nuclear plant in more southern and central Ukraine during this war, and the threats that Putin has made to the potential either damaging of that site, threats that are unsubstantiated by the IAEA of actions of Ukraine, or their own threats to bomb it if the war was a threat to their own national security in Moscow. One of the things this article does very well is it highlights the dilemma of any post-Soviet site, as many Eastern European countries expressed also in the 90s and the last two decades, of what it meant to be over-industrialized without concern about pollution. And so particularly Drew's focus on pollution, Christina's focus on the outcome of damage from mining industries have led to the ongoing destruction that Ukraine has faced even before the invasion of 2022. And I think that one of the big concerns that is being faced that they highlight is that there are substantial risks to the food security of the globe generally because of this invasion. I think very few Westerners understood that Ukraine was the virtual breadbasket of so many countries, as many as 45 countries in the world who'd be recipients of over 33 million tons of wheat, grain, soybeans, corn, related exports globally. And that's why the decision of the Russians to essentially destroy most of the harbors along the Black Sea and to stifle, if not strangulate, that export dynamic from Ukraine led to international, in a sense, a lot of collaboration and finally an agreement to, at least for the first year of the war, to allow so much of the exports through. Of course, the Russians probably took about 6 million tons of that themselves, sold it under their labels. Some of this stuff is pointed out in the article. One of the things that I think is very clear in the collaboration here of Christina and Drew is that the damages from war to the environment are ongoing and endure even after the shooting stops. So right now we're dealing with the combined nuclear threats from Russia and the damage, potential damage to nuclear sites, but we're also dealing with what happens when you devastate seven cities in almost complete form, as Russian bombing has done during this war. And I know these two good researchers will remain committed and working on this, but our viewers and readers can see it in this particular article.
Great. Thank you, George, for this really profound summary of the argument in this piece. Since the piece is published in our peace policy, do you want to say a few words of what might be the policy recommendations with the kind of urgency that you just articulated?
One of the things they draw attention to at the end of the article is Ukrainians are, on the one hand, in areas that they're able to repair and begin to rehabilitate, they're doing so with a heightened sense of environmental consciousness. And I know most folks understand that there's a lot of discussion about what can you rebuild, how can you rebuild, how after this war is over, might the complete resurrection, if you will, of Ukraine take place. The notion that they point out that many Ukrainians are thinking about this in an environmentally responsible way is pretty significant. But they also raise the issue that global norms and environmental law are at a point in which Russians can be held responsible for the environmental damage they've quite consciously done during this war. And that is a avenue of post-war pursuit that you don't see discussed very much these days. And I give these authors a lot of credit for this.
George, let's turn now to Jerry Power's piece. He focuses specifically on the role of Pope Francis, and perhaps more broadly, the role of the Catholic Church as a global actor. Do you want to kind of unpack a little bit for our listeners Jerry Power's argument and how it connects to some of those broader issues and ways of thinking in terms of connecting the issue of climate change and the nuclear catastrophe?
Yeah, thank you very much about this prompt and the way you state it, because I know you as a scholar of religion and its role in peace building have an angle of vision yourself on the role of not moral and ethical dimensions, but of religious actors as political forces. And of course, Francis has not shied away from saying that it's time to speak with a moral vision to the most pressing crisis of our time. And he did so environmentally earlier on by the encyclical Laudato Si, but also in November of 17 in a conference that Jerry and I and a number of Notre Dame students were privileged to attend. He explicitly condemned not only the use but even the possession of nuclear weapons. So he's had these two legs to stand on and has begun to weave them together in a way that Jerry really nails, I think, very, very smartly in his own article. The first dimension that maybe we might even say on this terrible topic is a little bit something one could chuckle about, but it was said very, very seriously, is that Francis directly said that this is a sacrilege that wreaks havoc on what is most precious on our earth, which is human life. And he sees these two coming together to, in a sense, be not only existential threats, but in the environmental dimension, a direct deterioration on the beauty and creation that God has given us. And from that basis, he then, I think, carves out a vision of world affairs that blends the ethical and religious, but clearly for some, and for some a step too far for a pope, gives a political agenda as to what we're to do with it. Jerry smartly says, look, the first part of this is that the issues under discussion, whether it be environmental deterioration and climate change on the one hand, and the management and what to do about nuclear weapons on the other, we can't have these discussed only in economic, scientific, and technical terms. The issues are not morality free. And the introduction and very strong voice of Francis in this is that at its root are the roots of both of these, and they're joined together, is a moral crisis. And therefore, the moral voices of the world through the world's religions, of which Catholicism is one, should move on this. And this is why he's speaking and trying to lead and asking others to join and follow. I think this is most manifest, and Jerry underscores this as well, that in becoming a signature to the Treaty on the becoming a signator to the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, Francis said the Vatican is signing in order to add that it's an ethical imperative for disarmament that this happens. It's not only the need of a world to free itself from hazardous and destructive set of military forces, but that the fate of the earth depends on this, And it's an ethical imperative for leaders to understand this, not just a technocratic challenge. And then he moves to this second part of this framework that of all things being connected, which is Francis really takes on what we often hear from many other voices, particularly in the global South, that the powerful West believes there are technocratic solutions to this technological problem we have created. And he believes very, very strongly that we're rather without the tools if we rely only on technocratic dimensions, that is, a new weapon system that prevents the other weapon system from wreaking havoc is not the direction you want to go. In fact, very clearly in Laudato Si, as Jerry quotes, Francis said, "We stand naked and exposed in the face of our ever-increasing power," and that we must, in a sense, disarm ourselves ethically and morally and understand that nuclear weapons and climate change are problems that created by humans, rationalized by humans, and demand human solutions. So therefore, a new moral vision is called for. And yes, it's clear that it must be radically different than the one that guides us. And so finally, final part of Francis's framework is a call on a new multilateralism, a multilateralism that believes in the shared imperative of cooperative security. This is where Jerry points out Francis gets in a little bit of trouble with the realists in everything from political science as a discipline, international relations, but also those are the areas in which most global leaders are trained. And Pope Francis calls on us to reconfigure the way multilateral organizations, visions of national security, and ways to cope with nuclear weapons threats in particular are seen only in a realist light, that we need a more cooperative security in which we understand the interdependence of our securities. And again, this would be guided very, very strongly by a particular moral vision.
Thank you. This is so, so helpful. It really sharpens the issue. I mean, this notion of this is an ethical, there should be an ethical approach and a form of moral action to redress the convergence of the two catastrophe, the potentiality for nuclear catastrophe and the ongoing climate catastrophe, environmental catastrophe, how they relate to one another and how they relate to this increased drive for power and control. And that also leads me to maybe a related question that I want to invite you to reflect on, which also connects to Laudato Si and Pope Francis' critique and ethical prophetic intervention. And that relates to who profits from all this. So the question of capitalism or perhaps neoliberalism. You want to say something about that and how it connects to the issues?
I think you're right. It's inseparable from that. And there are ways in which Francis himself takes this on, in which he says that the lavish, technology-driven, and environmental costly ways of life in the West really put the rest of the planet at risk, even as our very minority status in that planet as the rich, the well-off, those with the resources to produce massive weapons, do so at our own peril without us knowing that. He calls us to a new way of understanding our connections to the earth, a new way to understanding the relationship and responsibility we have to the poverty, to the health, and future well-being of others on this planet. And so it's impossible, I think, to say, let's bring a new moral vision to the concerns of environmental health and nuclear weapons without understanding one needs to be critically self-reflective and engaged in reform of our own lifestyles. And I think as we both know, at this moment in which we're recording, which the Ukrainian war is not only ongoing, but the ravage of war is hitting a new dimension in the Middle East between Israel and Hamas, that there may be too many weapons producers that see their stocks going way up because you use more weapons and therefore you ask for replacements and you invent with each war a new weapon system that if we only had it in the prior war, we could have been more successful. And it's going to be a real guns and butter moment, I think, for the United States in particular going forward. And there's a connection here to be made to not only a moral and ethical concern, but as you mentioned, the important word prophetic vision, because you're going to be alone in a desert crying for less militarism, less nuclear strength, and less worry about the environmental implications of what we're doing and what's happening from those we endorse and supply our weapons to in ongoing conflicts.
Thank you, George. Let's shift to the third, obviously very interconnected contribution by Rachel Bronson. The title of the piece is Measuring Existential Risk. She describes the difference between immediate nuclear destruction and kind of the catastrophic dimensions of a nuclear moment and the slow moving erosion, the climate catastrophe. Do you want to say a few more words, kind of unpacking her argument and once again, kind of bringing the policy implications?
Sure. And this is why we were so delighted that Rachel would have time to provide us an essay, because the doomsday clock of the bulletin, of course, has always been meant to try to impact the consciousness of the wider political, journalistic, and citizenry environments of the globe on how catastrophically close we are to our own self-destruction. The clock is a metaphor for how much time we have, literally, and the fact that in its last setting in January 23, they moved the clock to 90 seconds toward midnight, when not too long ago, we thought cooperation with regard to nuclear issues between Russia and the United States, more general de-escalation of tensions, more cooperation on the nuclear side would have put us, and did, further away. At the same time, the smart decision, as Rachel recounts it in January of 2007, for the editors and most importantly, the board of the Bulletin to say, yes, we may be making some progress on the nuclear side, but let us look at the interrelatedness now of other ways in which our human existence is in jeopardy. And from this, without a doubt, scientifically verified threat to our existence, which is moves more slowly, but as particularly we've experienced in the last 2 years globally, is not moving as slowly as we thought. We knew it was catching up with us. We knew we were running out of opportunities. We were missing what science told us were deadlines to be more interventionary. We knew that we were being more lackadaisical globally with various kinds of commitments that should be stated and worked on by Western powers in particular in their environmental impact and changing the climate. But now we better step up the pace, because the views of the destruction we've seen in the last 2 years globally, and even in the Midwest where the University of Notre Dame exists, our climate is changing in some noticeable ways. And so what Rachel has done is brought together, if you will, the slow but increasingly faster impact of climate change with not only the continued threat, but now also newly heightened threat of nuclearism that's going on because of the Ukrainian war, other developments, and sadly, the deterioration and abrogation of treaties that the Russians and the Americans themselves relied on for the past 2.5 decades. And so that we're in this listless system, as she calls it, of political consciousness, responsibility of leaders. She really is important in making the argument that in the history of the Bulletin's doomsday clock itself, the closer it got to midnight, the more we saw citizens' actions movements come to the fore, the more we saw scientific, religious, and social actors begin to form not only coalitions, but new arguments that were more and more persuasive and finally loosened dimensions of the rather staid political system to address these crises. I think she'd be the first to say, I don't want to be over-optimistic about this in this period, because we have a lot of indicators to see that an entrenched political elite in many different countries And I would add a swing to authoritarianism in a number of countries puts us on shaky ground for the likelihood that the massive movements from the early 80s on that pushed for nuclear disarmament, the global movements we're seeing at COP28 now and being able to move strongly globally with environmental citizens movements and the direction of the growing field of environmental peace building, will it be able to form those coalitions, those transnational dimensions that move us away from the brink? What's the confidence building measures that one can take to restore a Russian and American cooperative system of nuclear controls, which was embedded into treaties that one or both sides now have backed away from? How do we reconstruct in a stronger way that which we allowed to go by the wayside because it was politically or militarily inconvenient in the moment? And that's the question before us. Whether it's the bulletin clock or articles like Drew's and Christina's that have made clear to us the threat, the question is now, are political figures, are those of us as educators and researchers going to be able to move ahead with this and ring the bell in a way in which many, many communities hear and understand and call for action, whether it be on ethical concerns, whether it be on environmental concerns, whether it be on concerns for one's own grandchildren yet unborn?
Thank you, George. And finally, before we conclude, I had the great honor to work with you, to ask you, and that you accepted my invitation to be a guest editor of this issue of peace policy. I wanted you to be the guest editor for this because of your immense experience on very, very similar questions. Do you want to share from your own experience, especially the question of nuclear disarmament, but any other dimensions of your extensive work, any other kind of wisdom that we haven't covered yet, or any other kind of insights that you want to share with our listeners?
Oh, well, thank you. One of the reasons I was, as you know, so excited about your decision that we had a shared existential crisis and peace policy ought to reflect that, was when I thought about the earliest days, even the pre-days of the creation of the Kroc Institute in the fall of 86, what Mrs. Kroc and Father Ted Hesburgh, as co-creators of the Kroc Institute, were most insistent on is that we roll back the nuclear crisis of the 80s between the United States and the then Soviet Union, and that we've created a generation free of the threat of nuclear war, and hopefully free of the threat of nuclear weapons themselves. I remember one of the earliest events that Father Ted invited me to when I was still just a consultant to the university on the creation of something like a Peace Institute was a marvelous dinner honoring Jim Muller, Notre Dame grad, a member of the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, who had won the 1985 Nobel Peace Prize. And his enthusiasm and many of the founders and the original board of advisors of Kroc for us working on the nuclear issue. And in fact, the great program that Mrs. Kroc was most interested in, which became our master's degree, what she and Father Ted insisted in the first couple of classes is that we have two students from each of the nuclear powers as being the core of that class, in which they would create a statement at the end of the master's degree about how the world might move in the direction. So I often affectionately and somewhat comically would say to audiences in the late 90s that we started off as kind of a Noah's Ark of students, two students from each of these nuclear powers struggling in the 80s, but also seeing the changes that did occur. And I think when I worry about the kind of situation we're now in, that this essays in the issue reflect and that we're all thinking about on a daily basis now, there was relatively little hope in 86, 87, even into 88, that we wouldn't be locked in this dilemma for a long while. But as Rachel points out, there was a demise, there was a refresher period, there was a period of denuclearization. So we've just got to figure out in this context with the dual threat as well as new dimensions in front of us, how we're going to deal with this. As you know, since you've invited me to say something, that much of my own career was developed around the notion that multilateral cooperation through the United Nations, particularly through the United Nations use of sanctions, might stifle the development of nuclear weapon systems in some other countries. I think there are ways in which that did move forward in a positive direction in some cases, in particular the Iran deal, which was then blown away by rather arbitrary criteria a few years ago, and we struggle now to reconstruct, and it's not unrelated to some of these current difficulties we're seeing and threats to regional security in the Middle East. And to imagine a U.S.-Iranian relationships could have grown in a quite different direction as a result of the agreement in 2015, where we would have been 8 years now after that had it been, and the international interdependence and cooperation we could have built with Iran would have put us in a much different position than we are now in a number of respects. But I myself have begun to worry, particularly in the North Korean context, of whether or not we shouldn't be about the business of less reliance on constraining and coercing states to give up weapons, and more finding inventive ways to incentivize that through greater global cooperation, economic development, and being part of the construction of a new security system, which relies less on these weapons because states can feel much more secure without them. And that's the creativity sparked by a moral vision that I think has got to guide the work of many of us. And I know Kroc Institute will be instrumental in the days to come.
Thank you. This is incredible. And really key words here are multilateralism, interdependence, security, our sense of security are interconnected. And really the climate and the environment and pandemics have really illustrated that point.
Certainly, yes.
Yes, yes. And I was thinking, I mean, you mentioned Iran and the regional dimensions, and of course, Israel is also a nuclear state. So it's interesting to see the kind of the different approaches of the United States to the two powers in the MENA region.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Professor George Lopez, for being here with us and for guest editing this important peace policy issue.
And for those of you listening, we would invite you to check out the full peace policy issue at peacepolicy.nd.edu.
So you've been listening to the CROCcast, Peace Studies Conversations, convened by the University of Notre Dame's Kroc Institute for International Peace Studies, part of the Keough School of Global Affairs. So for our listeners, you can find all episodes of the CROCcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spotify, and online at croc.nd.edu/podcast. You can also rate and review our podcast, which will help more people find our show. For more updates, stories, and videos from the Kroc Institute, follow us online on Facebook, X, formerly known as Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube.